Indeed. Welcome back, everybody. It's the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin alongside Dom. Dom, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excited. We are back to talk partially about another documentary movie continuing, you know, the beginning of hopefully what will be many podcasts about various documentaries. But beyond just the movie AlphaGo, which is what we're partially here to talk about today, Dom, I'm really excited to dive in with you on something that we've actually wanted to podcast about for a long time at this point, and that is just the general idea and the current state of the world of artificial intelligence, which is something you know a decent amount about. I don't want to oversell it. You get mad at me for overselling how much you know about AI, but we'll get into your whole background with that. But yeah, I'm excited to dive into something not, you know, beyond just reality TV, and in particular something that I think certainly for me, and I hope for a lot of the listeners, people will find interesting and get a lot out of.
It's a topic that you hear a lot about nowadays, and no one seems to know exactly what's going on. And there's this phenomenon that you notice whenever you spend a lot of time working or studying one particular thing, when if that comes up in any general context, like in the media, you realize just how little they know as well. And you wonder, like, am I meant to question every statement that I see in public about this kind of stuff? And I know there's a name for that, and I'm not quite sure what it is. So getting this off to a sterling start, as always. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with this. And there's a lot of hype around the general topic, lots of hype around AlphaGo in particular, and this documentary is a great example of that. And very excited to dive into all of that and hopefully unpack that for you and for people out there.
Yeah, here's a fun behind the scenes that I don't think we've ever talked about on the podcast itself, but it would have been like a year and a half ago or something like that. Dom was actually in America in Boston, and we actually sat down together in person for the first time to record a podcast. We were talking into the same microphone. We were at my friend's apartment just waiting. My two friends who live there were both at work, and we were just killing time, and this had been something we'd always wanted to talk about. And once we got about 25 minutes into that podcast, one of my friends got back to his apartment, and we felt very awkward and just shut it down and never resumed it. But this is not our first time actually attempting to dive into this subject matter, but I'm excited to actually get the full version of it today, I suppose, Dom, and be a bit more thorough this time around. So let's begin with just your background in this field.
So I was studying for a master's in computer science, and as part of that, you have to select a topic to do this deep dive into for what they call a personal project, what I guess in some places in the States you call a thesis or a dissertation. So I chose fraud detection in online poker. So that involves AI in a few different ways. So the problem itself is something which is a result of improving AI techniques and that being used for malicious purposes. And then as a counterweight to that, we're also exploring how you can use these ideas and these techniques to better detect those players in real time.
So what is, I guess, just on a basic level, artificial intelligence, and just as, you know, explain like I'm five, as you can put it, how does all of this actually work?
So that's already a fairly tough question. So just defining what intelligence is already a fairly tough step. And so artificial intelligence, either it's so obvious that it's trivial, it's just things that are intelligent being done artificially, or there's some other aspect to it that's hard to capture. So as a useful descriptor, it seems doomed to fail from the outset. But that's compounded by a few other issues. So it's become very trendy to talk about AI just whenever computers are invoked in any kind of corporate setting. It's gone so mainstream that it's become this buzzword. So the same way that big data was a few years ago, like anything that used statistics in any conceivable way ended up being lumped under the umbrella of big data. And if you don't have a background in the subject yourself, it can be hard to distinguish just from news reports by people who maybe also don't have a background in it, whether it's actually a thing that is being used for a specific purpose here, or it's just that's a term that they're pattern matching because that's what they've heard about before. And on top of that, it's hard to nail down a definition. It's necessarily fuzzy because it tends to be used to talk about things which are on the horizon but not quite there yet. As soon as something is proven enough to be widely accepted, it tends to drop out of that definition.
So given that the definition of artificial intelligence. It seems to be constantly evolving, and how we're applying it seems to be constantly evolving. How far back do we date just the concept of artificial intelligence? Does it start with Alan Turing? Does it necessarily have to be like computer oriented, or is it the wheel artificial? I guess the wheel's not neither artificial nor intelligence, but you know what I'm saying. Would we classify archaic inventions as artificial intelligence for the time?
So that claim about the wheel is not as clear as you're making it sound, at least according to some people. But
example, I'm sorry.
No. We can get into that later. But it's always been a hypothetical question that has interested people. So if we were able to devise some kind of system that could automate these processes or find ways to understand things for itself. And again, we're using understanding quite loosely here. One of the big problems when talking about any of this is we have to use this human-centric language. We talk about computers understanding things, knowing how to do things, behaving in a certain way, seeing things, feeling things, when we just don't have the vocabulary or the conceptual knowledge to think about what actually is going on behind the scenes.
Is there going to be some future where I can hurt a computer's feelings? Because I really want that. A turnabout is totally fair play in that capacity. I'm psyched for that day.
Yeah, there will be decades and decades of grudges built up over time by that point that you want to seek some retribution for. But the actual idea of artificial intelligence dates back to the mid-50s, early 60s, when that became a codified concept. But it does stand out, if you look back at those early discussions from 50 years ago now, that they, at the time, had no idea where it was going, how long it would take, what the ultimate goal of that would look like. And we in many respects, we're no closer to any of those things today.
Yeah, actually, that was something I was going to ask about. Was I remember it must have been like 2013, 2012, somewhere in there. I heard the news that checkers had been solved, and I was floored to see that Go, as all of this was happening, I heard about the AlphaGo match in real time, that in such a quick turnaround between like 2012 or roughly there, solving checkers, to early 2016 solving Go. It seems to me like some kind of emphasis was placed on, for whatever reason, using these games to help develop artificial intelligence in the larger sense. What sparked that, or why do people feel like artificial intelligence is generally something just worth pursuing to begin with?
So if you're someone who is a fan of these games, has been playing them for a long time, obviously you're going to be interested on that level. But more broadly, this has wider applications. So one of the first quotes you hear in the documentary is, they don't just want to understand Go, they want to understand what understanding is. And that's a commentary on documentaries like these two, because you have all of these deep dives into various niche subcultures or into these projects which you don't have the technical know-how to understand, maybe, but those are interesting because you wonder, how does this generalize across? You know, what is it about this which extends to any kind of investigation like it? So you can watch a documentary about someone's quest to be the best competitive gardener in the entire world, and even if you don't know a thing about competitive gardening, you're interested in that because you see the drive to solve this problem and to achieve mastery of something. So there's that aspect to it. But on a scientific level, you're not just exploring games for their own sake. You're looking for techniques which can be used for a wide variety of problems. And you can actually contribute to big advances in that research using games, even if you know basically nothing about them. So various forms of poker have either been effectively solved or computers are reaching a very competitive point there. And the people behind those advances, by and large, are not poker players. Maybe they have a casual interest or they've become interested over the course of their research, but they don't come to that with any kind of expert knowledge. And likewise, for the AlphaGo team, you can see in the documentary, one reason they were so excited to have Fan Wei there was not just to give AlphaGo something to test its mettle against, but also to explain back to the people who developed it exactly what was going on, what their own creation was going for there.
Right. And I thought that was one of the most interesting aspects to this whole endeavor, was this attempt at solving the most complicated game known to mankind was being, produced by these people who were not Go players. They were more interested in just essentially, as far as I can tell, figuring out if they could use their computer science to solve this game that so many people thought would potentially go forever unsolved just by the sheer volume of possible permutations. And I think that that kind of approach of not, you know, the game could be whatever it is. It's we want to see if we can get this computer to figure this out beyond what humanity has ever been capable of. And I think that is a really interesting just kind of approach, like an endeavor to embark upon from this. What's the name of DeepMind is the name of the of Demis and his company, or what the group behind AlphaGo. I think that is just a really interesting perspective through like a way to approach the world and a way to, I guess in their case, like conduct business and pursue, you know, live. That's the essentially the purpose of their lives.
Yeah. So AlphaGo is the focus of this documentary, but DeepMind, the organization behind it, they've been working on a wide range of different problems. And games are a very nice testing ground for that kind of research, because they offer this this virtual environment, if you like, that its own sandbox, where you have these clear rules, you know what the stakes are, and whatever the problem you're looking at is, you can find a game which has roughly the same crucial features of that problem. So you know that if you make an attempt at cracking that game, then that can extend to whatever it was you were interested in the first place. So one of the teams at the University of Alberta in Canada, they were taking an interest in various forms of poker as a route to looking at things like security or medical treatment or civil engineering. So it turns out that a lot of these problems are much easier to understand and grapple with when you model them as games. One example that I took a specific interest in is treatment of diabetic patients. Ideally, you would get to see your doctor regularly. You would have this treatment plan that was constantly updated. But in the real world, doctors are busy, you're busy, you don't always have the time to coordinate that. And then between checkups, maybe your diet habits change, maybe your exercise habits change, you start taking different medication, you experience new side effects from medication. So you're looking for a treatment strategy that guards against those worst outcomes while offering a level of consistency and being robust against that kind of uncertainty. On the face of it, that doesn't seem like it has any connection to poker or games more widely. But if you model that as an adversarial game where you have some like virtual opponent that's trying to poke a hole in your plan, and you use this game theoretic analysis to approach it, it's much easier to crack. And the same goes for, let's say, you're a town planner and you want to place storm drains around your city so that if there's some like freak weather event or a flood or something, your infrastructure is able to handle the fallout from that. So how do you distribute your drains in order to make sure that happens? Or if you're an airport security manager, where do you place your cameras and your guards to make sure that no one goes where they're not supposed to be? So all of these things, which sound like quite general problems, can be attacked indirectly by looking at these specific games.
So, yeah, and I think for me personally, my favorite scene of this entire movie, I think, was in whatever game it was where AlphaGo plays. Deep Blue was the computer that played against Kasparov at chess, where AlphaGo move 37 and the whole room reacts and they're like, oh my God, what a beautiful move. And as a casual chess player who has watched some like very classic chess game commentaries on YouTube, that is something that any, I think, person who dabbles in these kind of games will recognize, like those truly just beautiful moves that that any human could have theoretically played and seen and recognized as good, but just for whatever reasons are limitations that the way we view the world as humans don't allow us to see it kind of, I guess, in that dimension, so to speak. And it seems to me like the AlphaGo team is trying to use this computer, not algorithm, but this computer neural network, I suppose, to find the move 37 equivalents of life. Like, so while it may be go right now, like you're saying, Dom, our heroic storm drain manager, he's going to find some incredible new pattern that's going to make the town a lot more easily drained. I think that is, am I right in thinking that that is essentially the reason they are approaching these games, is not because the games themselves are some pressing need for humanity to solve it, but rather these are pretty concrete things with rules that we can be certain about. And hopefully by mastering these things, we can apply that to actual things that truly do matter.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it.
Okay, well, I guess then with that in mind, now that AlphaGo seems to, now that Go is out of the way, how is this going to be meaningful going ahead, not just for Go, but for the practical application of this or for other games?
Yeah, so I imagine these techniques will be applicable in ways that we are not even aware of yet, and which will take some time to make themselves known. But this in particular, it's worth noting that it's a big step forward for AI in many respects, just as a field of research. But that doesn't necessarily mean that any problem that involves AI, or which AI can be applied to in some way, this is going to be meaningful for. And to illustrate that, I think it might help to set up a contrast between Go, which is the focus here, Poker, which is the focus of what I was working on, and self-driving cars, which is doesn't seem like it's immediately related to those, and it will become clear why. But that's an application which has a lot of buzz surrounding it, and whenever AI comes up, that's the first thing a lot of people go to. So it might be interesting to see how seemingly is just an advance in one game can or cannot be applied to this completely different problem. So for games in general, most of them are, deterministic is the wrong word, but that when you take an action in that game, that the game state afterwards is predictable, in that what the range of outcomes for your action is. For anything that involves complicated physical motion or activity, that's not necessarily the case. So you can imagine that this robotic arm that you need to be in one position ends up a few centimeters away, that might result in a big difference in terms of what you're trying to accomplish with it.
So are you telling me that despite Go, the most complicated game potentially ever being solved, we're still potentially a ways away from our dream computer that can run out 1,000 simulations of Survivor because we can't predict who's going to throw the bean bags correctly?
Yeah, AI will not be solving Twister anytime soon, it looks like. But there's a class of games, including Go, which are full information, where you as the player can, in theory at least, map out every conceivable outcome for the rest of the game tree. For a game like poker, where there's hidden information involved, that's not always the case. There are other players in the game taking decisions using information that you don't have access to, and vice versa. And most of the tough problems that you would want to have a leg up in solving in real life share that same feature. You don't know everything that you would need to even begin to start addressing that problem.
Right.
So that's an issue which is going to come up time and time again, and that's one of the big incentives to look into hidden information games to try and find ways of redressing that balance there. Another thing that comes up is when you're trying to train an AI to do something, and we'll get into exactly how that works in a little bit, you need some reliable source of feedback. So it needs to be able to experiment with different outcomes and then use that to improve its own decision-making procedure. So for a game like Go or Poker, you can finish one game, there are no consequences, you update your own model of how you should play the game, and you just move forward on that basis. But for some real-life problems, you really can't do that. So your self-driving car that's going around on the streets, you can't afford to have that experiment with crashing into the pavement to see what happens, right? There's some limitations there on exactly what you can do. And it's not always easy to get that feedback. So if I make a decision in a hand of poker, I can see what happens and I can see the steps along the way that led to that outcome. But in a lot of cases, you might have lots of different things happening before you see the outcome of one step or one series of steps. And it's unclear how much credit you assign to any one step in terms of what led to that ultimate decision. So your AI might latch onto one thing as the cause of its success or the cause of its failure, when in reality it was a lot more complicated than that.
Okay. And another thing that I would imagine would be a big factor in whatever the game is, even games that have perfect or whatever, not hidden information, but complete information, it seems like the human element, whether it's Go or chess or anything where you can see the whole board and there is no variance or whatever, people just have different kind of play styles, and certain tactics work better against various different play styles depending on who your opponent is. I'm wondering how AI is even beginning to attempt to solve like that human element factor of so many of these games, where yes, they are great at coming up with like what is the best idea in theory if your opponent is playing perfectly, but I know certainly in poker and in backgammon and in games where like money is at stake, there are many times where the optimal strategy is exploiting your opponent's unwillingness or inability to play perfectly. perfectly. How are computers trying to adjust for the human element and the human factor?
I think you're getting at a few different things there, so it might be worth going through each of those in turn. So the question of exploitation comes down to what your priority is. So when they solved limit poker, this is what they were going for. That's about finding techniques for solving games. And solving here means you find this equilibrium strategy that can't be exploited. So no matter what the opponent does, there's no way for them to get an edge on you. And that's similar to what they're going for in the security example that I spoke about earlier, the medication example of finding a strategy that is robust against any distribution of outcomes, basically. So no matter what variables are in play, no matter what your opponent does, if you want to think about it in those terms, there's no hole in your strategy. So that's a very useful thing to be able to achieve, but it's not always possible. So when that's been done in various forms of poker, it's because the size of those games is low enough that that's something you can feasibly do with a realistic amount of effort and computation time. For larger games, so No Limit Poker, for instance, and Go certainly is way above the threshold for this. People like to talk about the number of atoms in the universe versus the number of game states. So that's a nice way of thinking about it there.
Like, chess players say that as well, by the way. And I think it is true that there are more permutations of chess games than there are atoms in the universe. But it's certain Go is even more complicated than that.
Yeah, for most games that are interesting enough that you'd want to try and solve them, the number of atoms in the universe is far in the rearview mirror. You've already greatly outstripped that.
I was thinking about the other day, just like the entire premise of chess. Like, I could sit down at a chess board opposite Magnus Carlsen, who's the best player in the world right now and many consider the best player of all time. And theoretically, nothing is stopping me from making the perfect move every time. I could do that other than I don't know what it is. I wouldn't have any idea where to begin with what that is, with what the perfect move is. But if I was sitting across from the best tic-tac-toe player in the world or whatever, just by sheer guessing, I could very quickly, in relative terms, come up with the perfect tic-tac-toe strategy.
Yeah, you would become the best tic-tac-toe player in the world in a very short space of time. And that there are millions of people out there who are tied for that that great honor. So when you're trying to solve games, firstly, it's not always feasible. And secondly, it's not always clear if that's something you would want to do if it were. So when you think about multiplayer games, that guarantee that no matter what your opponent does, you can't suffer as a result, that makes sense for two-player games. And there are certain other conditions baked in there as well, but we'll just focus on that for now. But when you add these other actors into the scenario, their actions can have an effect on you, and they can't improve their own situation, we know that much, if it's an equilibrium, but they can drag you down with them. They can have unintended effects on you that you have to anticipate and deal with. So in a game like Heads Up Poker, you have two players, you can model that and move forward. But if you're trying to model, let's say, an economic situation of some kind, you might have thousands of different actors working in that situation, and there's just no conceivable way to untangle all of that and work through it to find a clean solution. You contrast that with other cases where you'd care about maximizing your payoff. And in practice, if you want to be a successful poker player, a lot of that is going to be identifying flaws in an opponent's play style and hammering those for as long as those are on display. That's, in some ways, that's easier, and in some ways, that's harder. It's easier because you don't have to be as ambitious. You don't have to solve the entire game. You don't have to map out every corner of it in order to have a game theoretically complete solution. But in some ways, it's harder because you now have to model what your opponents are doing. And if they are dynamic in any way, if they are thinking at all, then that turns out to be quite a difficult problem. And so my work was dealing with, how do you build a useful model of how your opponents are likely to act and what that means in a short space of time? If what you care about is looking for red flags, of finding things which a human player might not do, but a computer player might do more often.
Right. I was wondering about that because we saw in the way the movie played out, the kind of like revolutionary thing that AlphaGo discovered, that it seemed like humans who were playing Go and even the best Go players of all time would often overlook, is the way Go works is just at the end of the game, whoever has more territory wins. It doesn't matter how much you win by. And that was the thing that humans tended to be overlooking, where the Go computer has such an edge in just looking at all that matters is getting the majority, no matter what the margin is at the end of this game. However, in poker, so like the entire premise of playing winning poker is maximizing how much you win when you have the best hand or can get them to fold, and minimizing the amount you lose when that is not the case. And I would say that is a whole different beast. And to kind of go back to what you were saying, in poker, you're often not going to be playing heads up. You're often not going to be playing limit poker. And frankly, that human element that we've been talking about is quite often going to be the biggest factor in playing winning poker. And as you were saying, finding the vulnerabilities in your opponent's game and really hammering them to the maximum possible effect. And I'm wondering just how that kind of strategy is being approached when it seems like the computer, as far as Go was concerned, was all about, it doesn't matter the margin, we just want to win at the end.
That question makes less sense in the context of chess or Go, where you might know your opponent likes to start with d4 instead of e4, but that's not really going to change your ultimate goal and the process that you go through to reach that goal. Ultimately, you're responding to what the game state is at the time, which is a result of decisions your opponents have made, and that's going to vary depending on who your opponent is, but none of that really changes anything. Whereas in poker, that is something which, yeah, if you're trying to exploit opponents and maximize your winnings, you have to think about. And that's yet another case where even between these two different games, you have these different features which affect how applicable these things are in the real world. So there are some problems where, yeah, all you care about is, do I win or do I lose, or do I get outcome A or outcome B, versus there are some problems where you have this entire spectrum of possible outcomes and you're looking to target various points on that.
Well, I guess that is something that they faced with AlphaGo, even being a game of perfect information. Like, you're right, it's not the case in chess or in Go, where, and frankly, often with like checker play considerations in backgammon, and like there is a concrete, this is the best move in this given position. Whereas in poker, it is so often completely opponent situational. Like, that is going to be the determining factor. If you're playing against a super bluffy player, you're going to want to take a totally different line than if you're playing against a total nit.
And to go back to the other part of what you said, it's not clear what the human element is really meant to mean. The popular dismissal that you hear of computer poker or computers playing that kind of game is they can't read opponents. So if you read in the mainstream media, not to bring that phrase in here, but if you read an article about poker, a phrase that you can be pretty, you could bet safely on hearing at some point is, a computer doesn't know how to bluff. And that's just, it's not even that it's wrong, it's that it's not even wrong. It's asking the completely wrong question, thinking about it in the wrong way. So what you're doing when you read opponents, when you try to put them on something or anything like that, is all you're doing is assigning probabilities and updating your model for how you should play accordingly. And computers tend to be better at that in a vast array of contexts than humans are, and there's no reason to think it would be any different here. And even if you want to say, well, a computer can't look into your opponent's soul and figure out what they have, firstly, yes, they can. If you wanted to train a computer to do that based on recent advances in facial recognition technology and various other aspects, you could absolutely train a computer to do that more reliably. But also, it's a basic misunderstanding of what you're doing when you try to do that.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, just poker is totally, not to get too deep into the technicalities of it, but like, poker is totally a game about the ranges of hands that your opponent can have and the ranges of hands that you could potentially have and how best to play things out depending on what's been going on and what's out there on the board. And I think a computer would have a huge edge in not being vulnerable to so many of the things in poker that just destroy the human players. Like, for instance, a computer, when it has like a combo draw and knows how much equity it has, it'll probably keep barreling once or twice. And then when it misses, I truly feel like with combo draws or with missed ace king that you keep firing away at, humans are so much more inclined to keep firing. They're like, no, I should win this pot. And a computer will never say that. A computer will always just look at what the ranges tell them about what the optimal move is. And along the same lines, as they won't be more inclined to like barrel hands that they thought they should have gotten there with and feel like they should deserve to win this hand, they also will have no hesitation firing away with hands that have, you know, virtually no equity if they recognize, hey, my opponent's range in this situation is super weak.
And in general, that might seem confusing or intimidating, but for the sake of what I was researching, which is how do you detect computer players and distinguish them from human players, that actually turns out to be one of the best advantages that the human side have. The fact that humans are so bad at this turns out to be an advantage, because if you're trying to design a bot to play against opponents, you now have to engage in these trade-offs of, I know that human players tend to have these flawed patterns of thought that manifest themselves in certain ways, and if I want my bot, my agent, to fit in, it's going to have to display those itself at various points. And yet what it wants to do in the ideal case is its optimal strategy might look very different. So how do you navigate that trade-off, basically? How do you maximize your winnings in a context where you have to try to resemble these flawed strategies in some way?
Well, okay, so I guess that is that the goal when you talk about people who are trying to solve poker? Is it, it's not, we want to solve limit heads up hold'em on a theoretical level, it's we want to develop bots that are good enough to get away undetected?
Well, so in a research context, no, because in that case everybody knows that they're dealing with bots. Often the games that you're setting up to trial these are just between different bots. It might be the bot playing against a recent iteration of itself in some cases. Whereas in the real world, you might have a table with some undetermined number of bots and a bunch of humans, and you want to make sure that your bot or bots, if you're operating a bot ring or something like that, are going to blend in among the wider population there. I think it's worth diving into that quickly before turning to the larger discussion here. So humans tend to be very bad at understanding and using randomness. So if we played the most simple game possible, I'm going to ask you to pick a number between 1 and 10, and I'm going to try and guess what you chose, and we just repeat that over and over again. What you would see over time is you would not have anything near an even distribution. It would be weighted in certain ways. The way in which it's biased might change just based on how you're feeling at that moment, how tired you are, or external factors which affect humans' play in ways which, for you, that's very damaging. If people can pick up on those and exploit that, then that's an issue. But for this specific problem, that's great, because if you're trying to design a bot to blend in, if you're this malicious bot developer, you don't have to try and capture that weird bias that humans have and encode it into your bot, which turns out to be quite hard to do. And even if, let's say, you were trying to apply a certain strategy in that game, let's say you've decided for whatever reason, I'm going to pick the number 2 40% of the time, the number 3 10% of the time, and so on, your actual distribution would look very different. It's hard for people to understand the strategy that they're applying, and if you print out that strategy and hand it back to them, they might not even recognize it as such. And that's for a game which is designed to be as simple as humanly possible. When you think about a game as large and complicated as poker, then that problem scales to an even greater degree.
Yeah, one of the in the movie quotes that I identified with, was the wonderful Fan Wei talking about how he saw Go as kind of like a mirror, and when he watches himself play Go, it's like looking into the mirror. Are these poker bots essentially hoping to look into kind of the mirror of what humans do wrong with poker and trying to replicate that so that they can blend in?
So the bots developed in research to try and solve the game, they don't care about humans, is the starkest way to put it. They don't care who they're sitting down at the table with. They aren't interested in any of the peculiarities of the human thought process. All they're doing is looking at the game from first principles and analyzing it from there. They don't need to know the history. They don't care about the history. If they knew the history, it wouldn't help them. It's funny that when the team that solved Limit Poker was designing one of their bots, they tried to hard code in this expert knowledge, which it seemed like would shortcut things. So never fold the nuts, let's say. It seems like instead of having it learn that for itself, you could just tell it that and skip that step in the process and move forward. But it turns out that introduced some weird irregularities later on, and just the process of having to consider that, learn that for itself, and realize why that was incorrect, it was necessary for the larger process to function properly.
Okay, well, I guess kind of what I was thinking about it in that, the example again from the movie that I thought was really interesting was where they taught the computer to play that brick breaker game, Breakout, I think is what it's called, and it didn't even know on game one, okay, the point is keep the ball bouncing messing up to break the bricks. Like the first game or two, it just let the ball fall off and it died right away. It eventually figured out, okay, I want to get the bar underneath the ball. And by 300 games had crafted the perfect strategy of, okay, dig a little tunnel up through the side, get the ball bouncing around up near the top. It seems like potentially starting from scratch and letting the game figure out, hey, don't fold the nuts, how the best possible hand that can't possibly lose, letting it learn that for itself could potentially lead us to some moves 37-esque breakthroughs in a way that if we are trying to force the computer to begin with an understanding of the things we already take for granted, we may be cutting off like the possibility for. I think that is an interesting concept of the idea that it could potentially be more valuable to start knowing nothing and try to get the computer to just build up its own idea of what the right strategy is versus like with Deep Blue, where they had all of these experts coming in to figure out the best plan of attack.
Yeah, so let's parlay that into the larger discussion then. So that process of importing expert knowledge and having to kind of manually work that in, that speaks to this larger distinction between what you might call symbolic AI, or it disparagingly in the industry is called good old-fashioned AI, where you essentially give it a set of rules and just have it apply those rules. So that's very good if you're trying to solve simple math problems, let's say, or problems which maybe they're not simple for humans to solve, but the way of formulating them or expressing them is fairly simple. And that also goes for some simple games. If you can enumerate all of the possible situations and tell it how to act in each case, then that's it. There's no further work to do. But you can quickly see that when the game gets sufficiently large, that's going to be a very strenuous process. If for a game like poker, you're having to manually go through every single point on the game tree and tell it what to do in that spot, well, that's going to take you more time than you could possibly have. And there are also some applications where it just seems like that just can't really work for. So language translation, let's say. You can tell it that a word means this thing in English and this thing in French, except when it's being used in this idiom or it's been used sarcastically, but sometimes in this dialect, then it doesn't. So you can see how when you try to actually sit down and formalize some of this stuff, it can be very difficult to do. And even when it's possible, it's very time consuming. So one example might be, let's say you want to train a computer to understand what a chair is. So you might say, well, a chair is something that has four legs, it's made out of a certain material, it has a certain shape, a certain structure. But then you get into these quibbles quite quickly of, well, is a wheelchair a chair? If it has only three legs, if it's a bar stool, is that still a chair? You have to think very carefully about what your definitions are. And depending on how rigid you are with those, you might end up either missing things which you want to be included in that, or including too many things which don't belong there in the first place. So the other approach, which I think you've been eager to get into now here for some time, is to train it to recognize patterns for itself. And there are different ways of going about that process.
Right. And I think this is the idea of what they called in the movie, like neural networks, of trying to mimic that that like human mind and be able to, in the case of Go, cut down the quadrillions and quadrillions of permutations that would take a million years for a million computers to go through all the math for and filter out all of the ones that are actually realistic, that like good strategy could lead us to these kind of positions. What is a neural network, and what is the approach there when you are these computer scientists trying to implement that into one of these games?
So you can think of it as an attempt to mimic the structure of the brain. You have all of these different layers of neurons, and whatever your inputs are, you're filtering them through all of these different layers until you get to the desired outputs. And eventually, the neural network is trained to understand these things and work them out for itself. The process of how you get there are a few different ways. So if you're going for supervised learning, what you do is you give it example inputs. You map those to certain outputs. So if you're trying to train it to recognize what a chair is, you show it a picture of a chair and you say, this is a chair. You show it a picture of a dolphin and you say, this is not a chair. And over time, these different neurons learn to differentiate between the key features of the different inputs and work out what is it about the chairs that make them chairs. And you can think about it like you have all of these different voters or these different bettors in the market. Whenever they see an image, they vote on whether they think this actually is a chair or not. And when the big reveal happens, the voters who got it right, their opinion counts for a little bit more. And the voters who don't, their opinion counts for a little bit less. And you repeat this process over and over again until you have this group of voters, this group of neurons who, if you group them together in this cluster, that is the, you know, they are the ones who have proven that they can recognize what a chair is.
That's incredible. I mean, that sounds a lot like just human or any kind of evolution, is these the characteristics that are going to excel are the ones that are going to win out over time.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. It's difficult for you to reverse that process, to unpack exactly what it has taught itself to recognize as a chair. And that's why you often see neural networks referred to as this black box. It's you don't really know what's going on under the hood in that process. And that can be awkward sometimes if you need to know the process. So if you're training this in order to figure out for yourself what's going on in a certain problem, then you don't actually know what the underlying cause and effect might be, let's say. Or if you're in a situation where you need to be able to explain it, if you're a doctor explaining to a patient why it is that we know you have a certain condition and you have to go ahead with this risky procedure, it's often not good enough to say, oh, well, the machine told us that that's what we have to do and we don't know why. Like that's people often more certainty than that. But if you think about what I've just described, you can see that human input still comes into this in a big way. And as a result, any mistakes that humans make can also factor into this as well. So you're feeding this network these examples with labels on them. You're training it to classify these examples, but those labels are the product of human decisions, right? So again, you come back to this question of, is a wheelchair a chair? Is Dan Lembo's giant chair a chair? Like, what exactly are we going for here? And in that case, it sounds kind of flippant, but there are many examples where there are these fuzzy boundaries between different concepts, and it's unclear if something actually qualifies as an example of whatever you're training it to recognize. So you can have issues labeling your data in the first place. You also need to make sure that what data you do have is reliable and tells the story that you want it to tell. So one classic pitfall for this type of supervised learning is overfitting, which is it's like teaching to the test, where you give it certain examples and your classifier learns to distinguish between those examples. But when it comes to the concept more generally, it's not able to apply that knowledge and use what it's learned. So you need to have the right kind of training data, but you also just need to have enough training data, which is an issue sometimes as well. So for Go or for poker, it's trivial to find thousands of examples of games played by top human players that you can feed into your network and have it ruminate over. But there are many real-world problems where getting appropriate training data is a very time-consuming or very expensive process. And in that case, you're asking your classifier to do a lot with very little. And this is one of the things that people like to treat as a preserve of human intelligence, this unique property that only humans can enact of being able to quickly relate these different concepts together and apply like this common sense reasoning. So one example that comes to mind is Google was training one of their classifiers. They kept feeding it images of barbells, and they realized that in the examples they were giving it, all of the barbells were being held by people. So they had these arms attached to them. The network looks at that and it thinks, oh, what it is to be a barbell is, you have like this hammer looking thing and it has this weird protuberance on the end that's leaning into the photo, right? A human looks at that and says, well, why are you so stupid? Oh, of course, a barbell is just that thing that they're holding in their hand, right? And they can very quickly come to that conclusion and isolate what the key concept is. But humans can only do that because you bring in this existing conceptual knowledge to do that. The other side of that coin is computers can do that in a way that humans can't. So if instead you don't have something which you already recognize, let's say you have a massive spreadsheet with tens of thousands of rows and columns, and they're all anonymized and they're all shuffled about, and you're just looking at this undifferentiated mass of data for the first time, you're completely lost, right? There's no headway you can make there. You can't pick out any patterns or relationships between the data, whereas a computer can say, obviously feature 438 and feature 627 are related. So it's very tempting to think that that's a thing that only humans can do, and in some ways it is, but there's two sides to that, and it's worth keeping that in mind.
I wanted to get into this, and I'm admittedly a bit reluctant to ask a philosophy major this question, but this is another thing that they addressed in the movie. Demis himself brought up near the end, after AlphaGo was successful against Lee Sedol, the idea that, like, yes, this is a great victory for computers, but all of this was done by humans. Like, this computer, it's not like this just magically appeared. None of this would be possible without all of the work that humans put into this. What is this, like, where is the line, I suppose, between what is humans assisting computers in learning things and what is computers learning things for themselves?
I'll save the philosophy for later in the show, but you do bring up an important distinction, and that's why, in contrast to the supervised learning that we've been talking about so far, the next step, the holy grail, if you will, is unsupervised learning, where you can give unlabeled, unclassified data to your AI, and it can discover these relationships for itself. And that's so appealing, not just because it saves you all of that time and effort, and it stops you from making mistakes that might infect your investigation, but also because your AI might discover patterns there that you didn't know were there, and which might actually have some use for you, but which you never would have established otherwise. The other element to understand here is reinforcement learning. So you take your AI and you have it play against either itself or some carefully chosen opponent over and over and over again. And it experiments with a lot of different possibilities, and it learns which ones will lead to good outcomes, which ones will lead to bad outcomes. It adjusts its set of values, and then it just repeats that over and over again. Now, for a game the size of Go, it's impossible to explore every different possibility. So you can't do this by brute force. What you have to do is train this intuition for which moves you can exclude without even needing to think about it, and which positions in general are favorable for a player. And if you look at studies of how chess grandmasters, for instance, tend to approach the game, it's not that they are that much smarter than the average player one tier down, or that they're expending more mental energy to look an additional three or four moves deeper. Over time, they've developed this kind of pattern recognition, which they maybe can't quite articulate. They might not be able to explain to you in the moment why a given move is bad, but they've internalized over time this reliable process for determining that it is. And so one of those studies involves rearranging the pieces on the board and then trying to get the player to reconstruct it afterwards. It turns out that for most common positions, or positions that you could realistically reach within a normal game of chess, the better players are more likely to be able to rebuild that board accurately afterwards. Whereas if you just scramble the pieces entirely, so that it's not even a chess position anymore, it's just a chess board that happens to have chess pieces on it, the better players prove to be really no better ultimately at remembering that afterwards than players who are worse than them. So returning to the main point, that's what AlphaGo does better than its predecessors. That's part of what the big breakthrough is here. All of these techniques were known before. These were standard tools in the AI developers' arsenal. It's that they were able to combine them in a way that made the overall process that much more efficient and reliable. And this isn't just something which applies to Go. This setup can be taken and used for any problem that's in that same general space.
How does this compare to, I know you're not a neuroscientist, at least not yet, Dom, but the way that just we have figured out that humans learn things for ourselves, are we at all like the way the computers successfully learn things, or what's the is there a way to even compare the human just the way that we accumulate knowledge to the way that computers do?
And that's part of what makes this topic so fascinating for me. It's that you can find all of these crossovers with so many different disciplines. So the topic of language learning, for instance, that's something that's interested linguists, obviously, but also psychologists and philosophers for a long time. And if that's something which you're trying to train an AI to do, or that's an area you want to move into, those other fields of research are going to have important input that you need to take into account. So in the philosophy of language, for instance, one of the famous questions is, how is translation really possible? It seems that children are extraordinarily good at picking up language and picking up the meaning of individual words and phrases, and that's especially impressive given how complicated language can be in practice. So one famous thought experiment is to suppose you're learning a new language just by spending time with a native speaker and seeing which words they use in different contexts. So there's a rabbit that you see hopping by, and they say a word, pointing at the rabbit. Now, you don't know if they mean that's a rabbit, or that's a white rabbit, or that's a white thing, or that's motion, or that's an animal. There are all of these different inferences that you can make, and it's unclear what's actually going on beneath the surface when we choose between them implicitly. So it turns out that when cognitive psychologists have studied this, they identify certain shortcuts or biases that we apply to simplify that process and make it easier. And what DeepMind found when they compared that to how their AIs were training to learn language themselves was they found the same biases and the same shortcuts in play. So one example is that both humans and neural networks tend to focus on shapes when learning how to compare and classify images. So if you show the same image, except that the color of an object has changed, but the shape remains the same, it's more likely to classify that as an example of the same thing than if you change the shape, but let's say the color remains the same or other aspects of the image remain the same. And these experiments are being done in a context where the potential for human biases in how they classify the input data that we spoke about before, those are minimized because the images being used are very abstract, very simple things, and it's easy to control for the specific thing that we're interested in looking at.
I think I may just be like being super pedantic here and just like narrowing in on the entire concept of what a noun is, what constitutes an item.
You are now a professional philosopher, so congratulations.
Right, I'm not saying like we can type in, hey, Google, find me a picture of like the human psyche. That's I think that is a more interesting kind of endeavor to pursue.
So what the team that worked on Google Translate found was you could configure neural networks in a way that could accommodate the quirks of language using a thing called word embeddings. So what you're doing here is you're basically taking your word, and it's like you're placing it on a map, and on that map you can find its relation to lots of other different words and phrases within that same space, if you want to think about it that way. And in a language as large as English, you're not going to be thinking, how does this one word relate to millions and millions of other different words? So you might group similar words together. You might decide some words aren't important enough, we don't really care about those. So you have a word like dog. You want to see what its relationship is to the concepts that we associate with dog. So how does dog relate to animal or tail or furry? This gets harder in some cases. So if you're trying to deal with idioms, let's say, if you have a dog is a man's best friend, there are a few different parts in there, and it's more than the sum of those parts. So trying to reduce it down in that way might not be as effective. And that's why that's still one of the things that when you use a service like Google Translate, it sometimes has trouble dealing with, where it can't easily capture that. But you keep track of those relationships. So dog and man together have a certain score, if you want to think about it that way. Dog and cat have another score. And you keep going down the line. And for any given pair of words, the vast majority of the time, they aren't related in any meaningful way. And so the distance, if you like, between those two words and between the same word and some other word is going to be the same. So the famous example that comes up is king and queen, where if you take the set of scores for king and you subtract the set of scores for man and then add the set of scores for woman, you end up with queen, because that essentially reduces to the difference between man and woman. But the distance between king and light bulb is not going to factor into that equation at all, because those two things aren't connected in any way. So that allows you to express the fundamentally difficult task of translation in this intuitive mathematical way. And it's imperfect. There are still some kinks that you have to iron out. But that's the basic concept that's going on here.
So it seems like it's particularly with language, but I'm guessing just in general, the classic test that I've heard of, the Turing test that I've referenced before on this podcast, can you define, I know roughly what it means, but can you give us the layman's explanation of what the Turing test is?
The Turing test is basically, can a computer act intelligently in a way that's indistinguishable from a human? So that can be in a general sense, so artificial general intelligence, which could replicate human intelligence or even surpass it in as many fields as possible. But you also see it apply to specific like domains of interest. And you sometimes hear the term used in other contexts as well. So in some circles, you hear about the ideological Turing test, which is, could you pass as a supporter of beliefs that you don't actually hold? And if you could, that's meant to signify that you understand those beliefs and the mindset that you would have to hold them well enough that you could pretend to be one of those people. And that's meant to show that you have, I guess, empathy or understanding of what the debate is about.
So is that the goal, like, with language in mind, or with these other things in mind, is the driving motivation behind AI, in not in every in context, obviously? Like, I'm sure there are plenty of capacities where, like, the goal is improving medical research or whatever the case may be. But with things like this, is it really just to, as closely as we can, replicate human behavior, or is the goal, let's go beyond that?
So for language, more so than maybe any other example, actually, the answer is yes, because language just is as it's used by people. So being able to mimic effectively how people do use it in practice is the ultimate goal there. But more generally, the Turing test has faced some criticism as a benchmark for a certain level of intelligence. In many cases, we take an interest in machines performing a certain task precisely because they can or do in fact do it much better than humans can, and often in ways that are much different from how humans either thought to approach the problem in the past or have to approach it based on their own limitations. So in that case, it feels weird to set this as the test of whether a computer is truly intelligent, because as I described in the poker examples, often a machine would have to dumb itself down or play at less than its full capacity in order to properly mimic human play. So in a case like that, that might be the perfect example of where a Turing test is necessary. You want those two things to be indistinguishable. But for the most part, your ambitions are higher. You want to surpass human intelligence, not just learn to copy it.
Oh, I guess maybe a more general question. Are there a lot of philosophy people that go into computer science? Because that may be a hang-up for this whole entire field. If that's a common, you get your philosophy undergrad and then go into computer science, we could be here for another couple of centuries.
Well, there's some interesting backstory there. So when AI was first being developed in the 50s and the 60s, early 70s, there was, within philosophy, a lot of debate over what this truly meant, and not just for scientific developments too, but whether it would cause philosophers to question some of the assumptions that they had held for a long time as well. So there was a guy at Berkeley in the 70s called Hubert Dreyfus, who was one of the main figures in continental philosophy, and I'll explain exactly what that means in a bit. But his position was that the whole premise of AI research was going down the wrong path, because it was assuming we can and should try and emulate human intelligence and surpass it in ways that would obsolete humans in many respects. And he wrote this book called What Humans Can't Do, which was re-released about 20 years later as What Humans Still Can't Do, arguing basically that there are categorical differences in the capabilities of humans and machines, and trying to bypass those is just going to be a massive waste of time, money, and energy. And this was before the advent of neural networks, which are trying to emulate or at least model what we do in human cognition. So some of that stuff looks a bit outdated now, but a lot of it, I think, has still stood the test of time, and it's worth revisiting now, almost 50 years later, to see how those assumptions are still taken for granted, not just in how AI researchers approach these problems, but how the public at large and the media try to understand them too.
Where has the philosophical debate gone to at this point? You said this guy's from the 70s and potentially still makes some pertinent points that would stand up today. But I would imagine as this is, I would guess, exponentially increasing in what we're able to, is exponentially increasing as far as computer technology. I am guessing the more things we are capable of, the more possible problems arise in terms of paths we may or may not want to go down. So the larger ethical implications of artificial intelligence, are there any areas of research that have been deemed like off limits, places we don't want to go, things of that nature?
So there is this larger debate within AI, or kind of adjacent to AI, about AI safety. So this comes back to the idea of a artificial general intelligence, or a super intelligence, which maybe is what you were getting at earlier, which is when you have an AI which is so advanced that it can decide its own agenda, it can build other AI to do things for it, when it can when it doesn't need any kind of external guidance or supervision, and it might become this own powerful actor with its own agenda, its own capabilities, and so on, then that could, this is like the sci-fi dystopia scenario come to life.
Right, I was going to say, I watched Westworld, and this sounds familiar.
Right, so the idea here is to judge, firstly, how likely is that, and secondly, can you do anything about it if that's if that's destined to come true in the future, and if so, how do you best ameliorate the worst effects of that? How do we manage this so that the implications aren't as bad? I don't know if there's even a big debate around it. It's more so there's a big debate around the entire question in the first place. So if you're someone who thinks that this is a big issue, it's not just a big issue, it's the big issue. This is an apocalyptic scenario, possibly, on the level of nuclear war, climate change. This is an existential threat that we should be devoting far more time, money, and energy into figuring out the implications of and trying to forestall before we get there. But if you're someone who doesn't see this as a serious threat, if you think this is a fundamental misunderstanding of progress within AI and what it means for something to be intelligent, then you're going to think, well, this entire question is pointless. And if you're trying to advance this in the political realm, for instance, if you see these people arguing that we need to devote all of this attention to this, as you see it, this unrealistic sci-fi nightmare, when there are so many more pressing real-world issues to deal with, you're just going to write them off as cranks and not regard what they have to say. So it's not even like there's a debate going on. There's a debate about if this even needs to be a debate in the first place.
Well, for the record, while I am concerned to an alarming degree about many real-world issues, I'm also kind of concerned about AI getting out of hand. I'm going to be honest about that being a problem that I could potentially see coming in many, many years from now, too.
But there are some important societal and ethical questions that have to be grappled with here in the real world, even if you give no credence to these ideas of a super powerful AI that's going to take over the world and destroy us all.
It seems like we're trying to implement this. Famously, like the example that I have in mind is like Google with the self-driving cars. And I feel like that is an instance where AI, I would be surprised, frankly, if like 50 years from now, and that may be even a grossly liberal time estimate as far as when this is going to happen, like if humans are ever even driving their own cars anymore, where do the ethics come in terms of like that could quite easily basically eliminate the entire like truck driver line of work? Like I feel like potentially I have not. It's been a while since I've read my Hubert Davis Dreyfus, excuse me, big fan, totally know his name. Was that the concern? Was the concern like computers are going to put us out of work?
So firstly, the timescale for this is always very hard to judge. So you said you would be surprised if in 50 years this hasn't completely taken over. There were people 50 years ago who were surprised if 50 years from then, i.e. today, we still had to drive ourselves around or do so many of the simple tasks that we still have to spend so much time on every single day.
I wanted to say, but at the beginning of the podcast, I wanted to say something that John Oliver, your hero, Dom, said at the beginning of his recent podcast about Bitcoin, or episode, not podcast. He does a TV show. They did an episode about Bitcoin where he's like, it is always very dangerous to make predictions about the future of technology. And I want to be very clear, I am fully on board with that. I stand by nothing that I'm going to say over the course of this podcast if you bring it up to me however many years from now.
Is that a massively original thought? Did we have to quote John Oliver to convey that to the masses here?
I just wanted to make sure you were nice and tilted for the back half of this podcast.
Wonderful. I see that's one thing that humans have to suffer from, right? And when we get robots that don't have to, that can endure your questions without tilting off horribly, the entire medium of podcasting will have advanced one step further. That example of like truck drivers being automated, that is the go-to case for the policy implications of AI and something that we will have to grapple with in the near future. But I think focusing it on that alone almost obscures the wider issue here, and it reveals some of the biases that are at play. So firstly, it's always the jobs that are perceived as low-skilled to get lumped in there, and that makes sense insofar as if you think these don't require any kind of special skill or talent, then it's going to be presumably that much easier for them to be automated. But it turns out not to be the case. Anything that AI can do more reliably than humans is going to be susceptible to the same kind of incentives and pressures. So, for instance, radiologists or any job that involves looking at medical data and trying to infer from that what the status of a patient is, it turns out that machines can often do that much more reliably than humans can. And so are we meant to think from that the entire job of a radiologist is under threat, that we're going to have a whole mass of laid-off radiologists revolting against the government or anything? Probably not, right? But it's interesting that the debate is always focused in those directions in particular. It's only when these jobs which are perceived as high status or more important are the ones that are susceptible to this that you're going to get any real political drive to confront the implications of this head on. So currently, if a few million truckers lose their jobs. There are lots of politicians that might be worried about that in the short term, but until there is sustained pressure from people who have power, who have money, who have influence, then there's not going to be any real drive or motivation to actually do anything about it. So that's the tension that's going to be playing out over the next few years or decades, and not in a way that's going to be reassuring, probably. There are some reasons not to be as concerned, though. So if you look at the job of accountants, let's say, my understanding is the job of an accountant 30, 40 years ago was much different than it is today. And that's largely because we have learned to automate or to outsource so many parts of what that job used to be. But that doesn't mean that nowadays there are many fewer accountants, or accountants are lower status or less well paid or anything like that. It's that by removing some of those basic functions, you're able to do more with your accountants. And so there is greater demand for accountants to do that and to fill those roles. And that's now become an even more high-skilled and high-status job, if anything. But that is where these two issues intersect, maybe, where if this increasing incorporation of technology means that existing jobs have this higher barrier to entry and there are maybe fewer of them to go around, well, inevitably, some people are going to lose out from that. And so the question becomes, how do you guarantee some kind of security for them in a world where they can't easily just go into another job in the same field?
With all of that in mind, do you feel like, or I guess, is there a general sense or an expectation in the AI community that, you know, among people who know what they're talking about, that artificial intelligence could potentially become like a major political issue going forward if it does become something that is taking over a noticeable number of industries that we've for so long have depended on?
Definitely. Yeah. And part of that is that a lot of the breakthroughs in AI at the moment, a lot of the most high profile AI work is being done in these large multinational tech companies. So firms like Google, Apple, Facebook, Baidu, only they really have the resources and the manpower to tackle a lot of these problems. Like you have lots of startups and everything that are involved with AI, but if you're looking at the big picture work that's been done here, a lot of it is being done in companies that already are incredibly influential and powerful, maybe too much so. And if they, rather than national governments or rather than any bodies which in theory are more accountable, become where all of this stuff is concentrated, then that is a big cause for concern going forward. And as we're seeing with the Facebook stuff at the moment, there's really no clear understanding of how to treat these companies in any like consistent legal framework.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what I was going to say, is it seems like artificial intelligence could become down the line. I'm not going to put a number of years on it. I'm going to be smart like John Oliver and just say, whenever this happens, I called it. I do wonder if it could be like heavily regulated by the government.
Well, which government is the issue there? Because if you might get this kind of arms race you get with deregulation, where if one country is placing restrictions on what you can do with certain types of data or anything like that, and another country isn't, there's a big incentive to move your operations over there or for that to become the next hub of AI research, right? And this is the kind of work that is mobile, that can move around that easily. And there's a lot of moves within both national governments and large tech companies to poach the best AI talent from around the world. So you see a lot of firms in China, let's say, and including the Chinese government, making this concerted effort to get the top AI researchers on board with them. And it's going to be very hard to undercut China in terms of ethical regulation and everything like that. So the future in that regard is maybe not so bright.
Well, we'll do our best, I'm sure, in that capacity. I'm sure we can put in a solid bid.
But there are some other ethical implications to think through here as well. So it's very common already, if you look at political debate, to mask these ideological policy goals behind science as if it has this veneer of objectivity. So you can always point to scientific research and say, well, the data shows that this is something that has to be done. But the issue there is that technology can often help you to answer certain questions, but it doesn't tell you whether those questions are the right ones to ask in the first place or how to use those answers. So one classic example might be profiling by police or by security services. As technology improves, you will more reliably be able to say that a certain person is at risk of something or more likely to commit a certain crime because of characteristics X, Y, and Z that they have. But that doesn't tell you when and how it's ethical to treat them differently based on that information. But you can easily imagine, and you already see this, people saying that this isn't just an expression of my own personal values. This is what the science tells us to do. And if you disagree with that, well, you're questioning science. You're standing in the way of progress.
So is it essentially just embraced at this point within the community that there is no hard and fast ethical line? It's just, but essentially with that in mind, we shouldn't, because there's no concrete line in the sand, or to mix metaphors completely there, that we shouldn't be pursuing it. Like, the fact that we don't know exactly what we want to do with it is not a good reason to not be going for this in the first place.
It's not a good reason. This is this research needs to be done and should be done, but there seems to be little awareness of how difficult these ethical questions might be, and not as much willingness to engage with them in the first place as you would like to see. Kumail Nanjiani, of all people, he had a Twitter thread that went viral a while ago saying that when he was doing research for Silicon Valley, he went around a lot of tech companies just asking them to not just explain their research, but explain the wider implications of what it meant for society at large. And they were very good at explaining all of the technical ins and outs of what they were doing, but very few of them had even tried to grapple with, what does this mean? Should we be doing this? As the quote goes, we spent so long asking if we could, we didn't think to ask if we should, or whatever the actual quote is. But that seems to be the prevailing mentality nowadays. And so when you see like Mark Zuckerberg hauled in front of the US Congress to answer questions from a bunch of old people who don't even understand how Facebook works, and he can just gently bat those away without even having to consider whether what he's doing is more than profitable, is actually ethical or sustainable for society at large. That's a larger issue here. Even beyond the technical challenges of AI, it's making sure that the people in charge of it, who often are not accountable to you or me in any perceivable way, have an incentive or are forced to actually engage with the relevant questions here.
So in thinking about Zuckerberg and all that's going on with that, you mentioned Facebook and Google and Apple are generally the people who are developing a lot of this stuff. Are there concerns about the bulk of the most meaningful artificial intelligence work potentially becoming like a monopoly? Is that a yes. factor that, yeah, that is
yeah,
a,
that, I would, okay. That's a massive concern. And depending on what you're looking at, you might require large amounts of data, which is either proprietary, so some company has access to it and you don't. You might not even have access to your own data as it's held by them, or it can only be obtained through somewhat dodgy means. So you might decide, this is something that is worth doing. I'm happy personally for my data to contribute towards that. I think that's a trade-off that's worthwhile, but you don't really get to make that decision. So if Facebook is conducting experiments based on stuff about you that they've gleaned from stuff that you, in theory, voluntarily offered to them a number of years ago, well, it's very easy for them to point to the terms of service and say that you gave all of the stuff to them, but you don't get to engage with that any further than that. You're essentially signing away your rights to have any say in how your data is being used. So even if, in the larger sense, it's something which you should be pursuing, there are some real doubts to have about who gets to do that and what controls there should be on those processes.
Because during the movie, I was wondering, when we saw all the people from DeepMind and, oh, there's Demis, he's so great and smart and adorable. I was wondering just what DeepMind was. Is Google funding that or what's going on? Because it seemed like this whole entire AlphaGo project seemed to be just like a passion project, as far as I could tell. Like, they were doing it just to see if they could do it. But are there just not? I was wondering just how many deep minds out there are. These places that are independently, as far as I know, pursuing these kind of endeavors, versus how much of that is being eaten up by the Googles and Apples of the world.
So I believe DeepMind was its own company started by Demis and his partners, and then that was acquired by Google. And this is a frequent pattern that you see of whenever a company becomes sufficiently successful, it gets bought out by a larger company, which normally you understand that's just something that happens and there's nothing too much to complain about. But when all of the important research in a specific field is being hoovered up into one larger conglomerate, that maybe is a cause for concern. Now, DeepMind in particular, I think, is quite good on these issues, and they're actually hiring an ethics and policy researcher at the moment. and they've displayed an interest in the wider implications of their work for society. So in that respect, they're better at that than most. But
are they looking for someone with a degree in computer science and philosophy? Because I feel like someone part of this podcast could be a strong candidate for this post.
Let's find out. But by and large, the issue is companies don't have to worry about it. There's no like business or there's no financial or legal incentive for them to engage with those issues in a serious way. And that's going to be a big problem going forward.
And I would also imagine that people who at whatever age they get involved in this kind of thing, the best people in whatever given year it is from that class of graduates would probably want to go and work for the Googles and the Facebooks. And it seems like it's going to just be a lot easier for these bigger companies to just be scooping up all of the talent.
Yeah, you can take a decently well-paid job in terms of the national average or whatever at some government position or at a university, let's say, or you can be earning hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars a year at one of the top tech firms. And unless you are so morally pure or so driven by some other purpose that you want to make that sacrifice, it's pretty clear where you're going to end up if you're looking at it dispassionately.
Okay, so just moving, before we move on, I suppose, too far from this topic, what are the other just major philosophical or ethical considerations or concerns within this community?
So we covered a lot of the ethical debates here. Let's move back to the philosophical stuff. And maybe this can be a regular segment, just me going off on some philosophical tangent. But for now, it is pertinent here, because even before AI became part of the national consciousness, and depends how you define consciousness there, but I'm using that for now. Even before that, there are these debates about what it is for humans to be intelligent and how it is that humans can be intelligent. Because the idea of humans even being able to think at the high level that we do and in the way that we do seemed almost inexplicable. And it's been an interest for philosophers for a long time now to try and puzzle out exactly how that works and how that coexists with what we know from biology and other areas of science about how the brain works and how the body works.
Does the brain work roughly the same way a computer works? Like, are we essentially learning through trial and error, like we're all over the course of our lives playing 300 games of Brick Breaker, essentially, and it's just to varying different results depending on how, you know, how functional we are?
I don't know, and nor does anybody else, and that's the issue that's at stake here. So it seems like humans are unique insofar as the physical structure of the brain somehow is able to produce this consciousness. So that's one of the big things that's at stake is can you analogize between what's going on in the human brain and what computers do? Not even how computers are structured, but just the process of a computer executing something or doing something. Are those categorically different, or are they just the same thing, but they manifest in slightly different ways? So it's always been this puzzle for philosophers of how the physical structure of the brain can give rise to what seem to be these non-physical processes or thoughts or whatever you want to describe the mental as. It seems like those are two different things, and yet they are tied together. So if I suffer from brain damage, that leads to predictable consequences in terms of how I can think, how I perceive the world, and so on. And it's never quite clear whether from biology or from philosophy how exactly that can happen. So you have a few different answers to how that might be the case. So one is that what we think of as the mental is just physical. There's no boundary being crossed there. It's just that any physical process with certain inputs leads to certain outputs, and that's what it is for something to be mental. And describing it as such is just being misleading and taking us down the wrong path.
Sounds a lot like there is no free will. Whatever you end up doing is because your brain is firing synapses to get you to do whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, so if you look at it from the other direction, it's how can the mental have any causal power over the physical? If I think I want an ice cream, and I find myself getting up, going to the freezer, or running outside to the ice cream truck, well, did I intervene in that process in any way? Or was that initial thought just a product of a physical process, and then me running to wherever I ran to was also a physical process, and I myself did not play any part in that? There's no one pushing a lever to get me to go in a certain way. It just is how the brain was operating at that time.
Right. It's the brain is just an organic thing within me that over 30 years has through hundreds of thousands, if not millions of different decisions has led me to go want this ice cream right now.
Right. And so you have that issue, which underlies all of these other issues. And then that leads to some rabbit holes you can go down. So, for instance, you might say that if you want to emulate how humans think or pursue this superior intelligence to human intelligence, well, one way to do that might be to just simulate the human brain on a larger scale or with more technological power. Now, regardless of how feasible that is from a scientific standpoint, the philosophical question is, would that even get you the same results? And so John Searle, for instance, who's a big figure in the philosophy of mind, argues that even if you could fully simulate the brain, why would you expect the same results? So you could build a model of how a plant works, for instance, with all of the different intricacies and so on, but you wouldn't expect that model or that simulation to be able to photosynthesize, right? That there are processes which seem unique to specific implementations of that idea, and expecting those to cross over is just unrealistic. So there must be something unique about the way the human brain is structured and operates that gives rise to consciousness and other mental states in a way that just having some computer simulation could never hope to do.
Right. I mean, I think a computer is almost always going to have a hard time factoring in like the human condition that I think just is such a baseline factor in so many people's when they wake up every morning, the way they're going to approach the day has so much to do with things that a computer could never begin to replicate.
Yeah. So one related concept there in the philosophy of mind is qualia. So what it's like to be something. So you could imagine zombies. They call them philosophical zombies, but it might be visually more fun to imagine actual zombies as you see on TV. It seems like they are kind of like walking or shambling around. They are human in the sense that they're structured the way the humans are. They have all the same physical processes going on, but they don't seem to exhibit the same consciousness. What it's like to be a zombie is not the same as what it's like to be a human. And if you built an exact working replica of a human in a lab made out of different robotic components, that would not have the same just life experience, if you like, of a human. And you can never hope for it to.
Okay, and how does that tie into just the larger question of what it means for a computer to be intelligent, if it even can be?
So all of these ideas are under the same general umbrella, and these are different diversions that you can explore. But the larger question here is the fundamental one that you're coming back to of what is it for a machine to be intelligent, if that's even possible? So the most famous thought experiment, which is a common thing in philosophy where you try to like set up this example, which it maybe is not physically possible, but which helps to illuminate a certain concept and help you think about it in a certain way. So the most famous thought experiment here is John Searle's Chinese room thought experiment. So the idea here is you're locked in a room where there's like an input grill and an output grill, and through the input grill you get a bunch of symbols in a certain language, and you're trying to translate these into a different language. So you're given this manual, let's say, with these input symbols on one side and the output symbols on the other side, like a dictionary, and the symbols come in, you look them up, you feed back the corresponding output symbol, and from the perspective of someone who's standing outside the room, they're getting perfectly sensible answers to their question. You know, they get the answers they expect. From as far as they know, they're told that a Chinese speaker is in the room, and they see nothing to disprove that, and so they walk away happy. But the question at large is, do you in the room, or does the room as a larger system, understand what it is to translate something into Chinese? Because it seems intuitively that the answer is no, right? Or maybe you have a different...
Okay, so I would say it kind of goes back to the question I was asking about when we were talking about language, of like, does it understand that, okay, when I'm Google Translate, I'm now doing for humans their version of my binary code. I would say in the case of like this machine that can perfectly give you the Chinese translation for whatever input in whatever language you put out there, for whatever you want to translate it from, I would say it's neither here nor there whether or not it understands whether that it is translating something. As long as it's giving you a perfect translation every time, what difference does it make if the process itself is aware of what it's doing?
So you are dodging the question in a very practical way. And the entire point of philosophy is to consider these questions, which maybe have no immediate practical relevance, but which tie into other things. So we'll go through this again. Would you say that the room understands Chinese or not?
I would say that in practical terms, if it is capable of taking whatever you give it in whatever language and outputting that translation in Chinese, then that, as far as I consider understanding Chinese, it does understand Chinese, but I do not think it is cognizant of the fact I'm translating things to Chinese right now. I think it's just a machine.
And that issue of cognizance is what's at stake here, right? It's whether that kind of cognizance is an essential part of what it means to be intelligent. Because if you take this principle and extend it as far as you can, if intelligence is just taking inputs and producing certain outputs, then lots of different things would qualify as intelligent under that rubric, right? So even something like
a calculator,
a microwave, right? You put something into it, it feeds out, it puts something back out. Is a microwave intelligent? Well, it seemed like that's not wrong. It's not even wrong. Like, of course the microwave isn't intelligent, right? And yet there are some people who do want to take a reductive stance on that. They would say, well, yeah, that's what it is. And to elevate that to the status of intelligence, as if it's something that's distinct or unique, is to miss the point entirely. When we talk about intelligence or anything mental, it is just reducible to physical behavior and inputs and outputs, and there's nothing special that goes beyond that, which to me, I think that has a lot of obvious limitations, but that is a stance that with various levels and nuance is defended within philosophy.
Okay, I guess my stance is, number one, philosophy is a total waste of time. But number two, if we insist on using philosophy, I think I'm with you.
So one way to think about this might be, like, let's say you implement a recipe, right? And lots of different people can implement the same recipe in different ways, maybe using different equipment. So you're baking a cake, let's say. That recipe itself, it does not have the features of a cake. That recipe is not crumbly. It doesn't taste good. It doesn't contain cherries or flour or whatever else you put in your cake. But the end product of that process that the recipe encapsulates does have all of those features. And so one take might be that's kind of how the mind works, is that the mind itself is just a series of behaviors or processes, but the end result, which is consciousness, is able to have these properties that can't reside in the process itself, if that makes sense. And then the final and maybe the hottest take on all of this comes from my boy Hubert Dreyfus, who I introduced you to just a minute ago, and who you're already madly in love with. So he is a scholar of like the continental tradition, so specifically Heidegger in this case. And his view is that what it means to be intelligent, what it means to be human, is to be embedded in the world and be engaged in the world. And so the idea of trying to replicate that in this abstract, detached process is just a non-starter fundamentally. So when we talk about what it means to be a chair, let's say, what it means to be a chair is the purpose that a human wants to use a chair for. So if I'm out in the world, if I'm needing something to sit down on, then I recognize something as a chair. That's what a chair means to me. That's what it is to be a chair. So if I see a bar stool, then yeah, that might be a chair. If I see a wheelchair, then that's a chair. If I see a wheelchair that's breaking down and one of the wheels has come off and it's got jagged metal spikes sticking out of it, that's not really a chair. I'm not going to deem it. I'm not going to give it that label, that qualification. And so the idea of training computers to act in the same kind of way, they can't do that. They might be able to construct this dictionary as he saw it back then, or maybe in modern terms to teach itself how humans use the term in practice to recognize something as a chair. But as far as a computer is concerned, that's just a thing that exists in the world with basic physical properties. Like maybe it's made of wood, or it's brown, or it has four legs, whatever. But the essence of what it means to be a chair can only be decided by humans. That's where the concept comes from. So an AI cannot come up with useful concepts in the same way, because those are concepts that we are giving to it. Those originate from us and cannot, by definition, originate from some kind of like simulated intelligence, as he sees it.
All right. We haven't talked a ton about the movie. I thought it was so fascinating to see over the course of this match between AlphaGo and Lee Sedol the moves that the commentators and the computer scientists behind all of it, when they saw them, they stood out as just weird or these must be wrong. And we now obviously know these are like the next level moves of Go. And I think that is like the most fascinating part of this whole documentary is seeing the reaction to that and seeing these brilliant people once they kind of get almost an answer key to the next level of this game that they all love. Even these world-class Go players, just the light, you know, everything suddenly clicking for them. I think, as they said in the movie, like, it's moves like that. That's why you play Go, is to find things like that about just the game and also about yourself. Like, they talked about Go being a mirror early. And when you play Go, you see yourself. I think it was interesting to me to see that kind of, it really did feel like they were all experiencing a totally new way of seeing the game.
And on that point, even though my thesis was about AI as it applies to poker, I began it with what I thought were two perfect quotes from two of AlphaGo's victims along the way. So not only did it have this very high-profile match against Lee Sedol, but then afterwards, they placed it anonymously on one of the largest online Go sites and had it play against the top pros on there. And it had a 60-game winning streak where it just tore entirely through the competition. Two of its victims along the way there included a former World Go champion who said, quote, "After humanity spent thousands of years improving our tactics, computers tell us that humans are completely wrong. I would go so far as to say not a single human has touched the edge of the truth of Go." And then you have this second quote from a 9-dan Go professional that sounds like something out of the Matrix. He said, "I can't help but ask, one day, many years later, when you find your previous awareness, cognition, and choices are all wrong, will you keep going along the wrong path or reject yourself?" And that's, there's something like weirdly philosophical and yet fascinating about that quote for me. But it does show, like you see in that second quote, this is a moment of existential crisis. This is this pursuit that you've dedicated your entire life and career to, something that is a big part of your own identity. You're now being obsoleted at. And it's not just you. It's not like you personally have you're suddenly worse than one opponent. It's that you as a species are now under threat by this amazing force that you hadn't had to contend with until now.
Yeah, I thought one of the most interesting quotes in the entire movie was, especially when contrasted to Lee Sedol's confidence entering the match, talking about how he hopes it's going to be 5-0 in his favor, maybe 4-1, and then after he loses the first game and then really doesn't seem at any point in game two to be competitive, after game two ends and he gets essentially blown out, he ends up resigning, I believe. He comes into the commentary booth for like the post game breakdown, and his quote is, "There wasn't a moment in time where I felt like I was ahead in the game." And this is the consensus best Go player on the planet who's been at the top of the game for the last decade. And after two games against this computer and very early into the second game against this computer, he felt like it was almost hopeless. And I think like that is fascinating to me that this program really did flip the entire game of Go and what people thought they knew about it totally on its head. And I think that's an interesting juxtaposition to a game that I play a lot of, backgammon, where in the 70s, the actually recently deceased Paul McGrill, like the godfather of backgammon, like the Doyle Brunson of backgammon for people who know about poker, the work that he and many others did in the 70s to try to figure out the math and correct play styles for backgammon, when computers came along, they were proven almost across the board correct. And it's crazy to see these Go players have almost the opposite conclusion here. And I will happily grant that Go is a much more complicated game, with probably much deeper strategy for humans to be off this far for so long. But it's such a crazy dichotomy between like backgammon and chess. We humans tended to have the right idea, whereas in Go, once they saw what the next level of Go was, as they said in the movie, this is what 10 or 11 Don play looks like. It looks weird and we don't understand it.
And the same goes for poker too. If you look back 10 years ago, you could find people stating with a very high degree of self-confidence that certain techniques or certain player styles were strictly inferior to the alternatives. And early work in poker AI challenge a lot of that conventional wisdom, and nowadays that challenge by the AI is the conventional wisdom. You are not in on the joke properly if you don't incorporate some of these techniques into your game.
You should have seen the reaction in like 2003 or so when Gus Hansen first came along and really pioneered that like super lag strategy in tournaments, and everyone was like, this guy's garbage, he has no idea what he's doing. And in fairness, in high stakes cash games he gets killed, but it's crazy just how right he was. And that's, by the way, backgammon prodigy Gus Hansen, who came into poker and took it totally over for a couple of years just by having a different strategy than everyone else.
He has always been stuck in 2008, which in 2003 is a great place to be, but nowadays maybe not so much.
Exactly. And then 2010 rolled around and things have not been as good for Gus Hansen in poker.
And this goes both ways too. So you spent a lot of time, understandably, gushing over move 37, but lest we forget, there was also move 78 by Lee Sedol, where he took a line that the computer calculated a human would only make maybe one in a few thousand times. And I think going into that match, that's something which he did not anticipate having to make. He did not think that move was in his own arsenal. But in that situation, against the toughest opponent he ever had or ever would face, he was able to explore the limits of his own creativity and his own skill at the game and dig deep and find this amazing move that no one had really anticipated. And that ended up flummoxing AlphaGo as well, because if you remember, AlphaGo initially was trained on examples of human play, and it's later intuition that there are parts of this massive space of Go that humans fear to tread. And if you're trying to prepare for matches against human players using their previous games as training data, then wacky moves like this are not going to be seen in there. And so it hasn't trained itself to react to those in the proper way. And you saw that for the remainder of that game in particular, AlphaGo was thrown off kilter a bit. And in the control room, you saw Demis and some of the other team members kind of perk up and realize that this isn't over. We haven't conclusively solved anything yet. Lee Sedol still has some more tricks up his sleeve.
Right, and that's what we saw in game four when Lee Sedol incredibly gets a game off of AlphaGo. It seems like the way they framed that is he figured out what AlphaGo's weakness was, and that was not a lodge. What'd they call it? Where you stick one in between the two. What did they call the play? Whatever that is, where you put one in between the gap between your opponent's two stones. For whatever reason, AlphaGo didn't anticipate that being like a viable strategy that most people would consider there. And that, it seems like, was what Lee Sedol was able to capitalize on. And I was wondering, like, if they were to play that same opening sequence again, I would guess at this point with AlphaGo, if Lee Sedol were to play that move, AlphaGo would be much better prepared for it. It was just something that they hadn't really practiced for. They hadn't done the thousands and thousands of iterations of that being a move that a human would find.
And this contrast comes up in chess in a different way as well. So we tend to focus here, and we have done over the course of this episode, on competition between humans and machines rather than cooperation. But it turns out that cooperation is an interesting rabbit hole to go down as well. So in freestyle chess, where you're allowed to work with chess engines, with chess computers to figure out what moves you want to make, in the first big freestyle chess tournament that took place many years ago, the eventual winners were not the team with the best human players. In fact, the winners were the lowest ranked players in the entire tournament. And it wasn't the team with the best chess computer or the best technical setup or anything like that. As I understand it, the winners had a setup that was fine, but nothing special compared to what anyone else had. But what they had that no other team was able to bring together was an understanding of the holes in their collective understanding that they could fill and which the chess computer was able to fill. So it was humans understanding how to use technology using their own uniquely human faculties, that kind of generalization, that common sense reasoning, to almost create their own self-awareness of what weaknesses we have and how we can fill those using this amazing technology that we now have access to.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think it lines up with what we were saying about Deep Blue, the computer that played chess against Kasparov, and I think it is probably a good message for the future that it is when you combine the computer way of thinking with the human way of thinking that you'll probably get the truly best results there. So, Dom, I want to give some credit to a couple other people in this movie that I really loved that we haven't brought up yet, but Fan Hui, the original guy who plays against AlphaGo, its first victim in the movie, the European champion who's not nearly on the same level as Lee Sedol. I thought this guy was the easy MVP of the movie. He was so fun, even in defeat early on, and then joining the team and being there for the whole tournament. I thought this guy was a ton of fun, and all of my favorite sound bites, virtually all of them, came from him talking about how Go really does reflect to him. It teaches him to view life through a more kind of true lens, and I really do feel like games are a perfect way of coming to a more clear kind of vision of the world myself. So I really related a lot to this guy and loved just the energy and enthusiasm he brought to the movie. I also loved Aja Huang, the guy who was one of the computer programmers for AlphaGo, who sat across from Lee Sedol and put the stones on the board. That guy was also hysterical.
Yeah, this is the computer nerd equivalent of being like a 5-year-old boy, imagining yourself driving this tank or something, just having access to this super weapon that you get to control and fire at will. But yeah, I really enjoyed having both of those guys there. And to go back to what you said about what Fan Wei said about games, I really connect with that. I think there is a lot to be said for games as a teaching tool in general, or as a means of self-improvement. In the same way that I covered at the start with how the games can be this useful testing ground for developments in research, because it offers this setting where you can control the conditions, you can get useful feedback about your actions, and you can reflect on what you can do better next time and what you need to improve. In much the same way, I think games can be the perfect tool for self-help, if you want to call it that, or for improving your own thought processes. And that can apply to so many different areas. And you have to be open to that self-improvement. I know that both of us, in the course of playing poker and other games, have come across so many people who just don't seem to possess an ounce of self-awareness, whether it's in-game or outside the game. And those people are just going to kind of blunder through and maybe have some success, but without really understanding why, or understanding the variance involved that maybe means that it wasn't entirely their own doing, and they need to be humble about the results that they've had. But if you are receptive to that idea, I think games are the perfect way of refining and sharpening and honing your own skills at whatever it is that you're interested in.
Yeah, I was. There's a world-class, maybe one of the best poker players of all time, certainly Eric Seidel, tweeted the other day about how grateful he was that he's also a big-time backgammon player, just that games have allowed him the opportunity to really train his brain to just think objectively and understand the importance of doing that and thinking purely in terms of like practicality, and how much that has impacted his real life and his overall happiness. And I really do believe that like that players of games, I think, are putting themselves in a really good position to better understand the world around them.
So to give just one example, in one of the other games that I follow, a key theoretical concept that gets brought up time and time again is inevitability. This idea that if over time one player strategy becomes just too good to handle, and there's no easy way to fight against it, then what you have to do is either win the game before that can happen, or to shift the motion of the debate, to change the axis that the game is being played on. And that's a very sound concept for games in general, but it also applies to so many situations in life. So the guy who is one of the most original and interesting thinkers in this game, and also outside that game too, gives the example of teaching children about alcohol or sex or drugs, where there are these very strong external pressures that they will be susceptible to at some point. You know, when they get older at school or they go off to university, they will be hearing about these things from other people that you never met before and have no say over. So as a parent or a mentor or a teacher, it's on you to identify that reality quickly and to teach them about those topics in a responsible way, in a setting where you can field their questions about it, or where you can be the first to anchor their perceptions of how they should act regarding all of that. And for me, that's a much more powerful and resonant argument against things like puritanical attitudes to drugs or to abstinence-only education than some study that says that actually 43% of people who are raised this way feel something, whereas only 38 who were raised this way. That's so easy to gloss over, whereas this has this intuitive force. It's compelling in a way that these abstract arguments simply aren't.
Yeah. I also want to ask you a little bit just about Demis and Lee Sedol in particular. I think I would say in watching this, Demis really was the face of AlphaGo for me, and they track obviously him being the founder of DeepMind and one of the lead developers on this. And tracking him as kind of like the face of AlphaGo and his personality kind of representing that, where he certainly seemed confident that they had done a good job, but even before the first game was never like anything bordering on cocky, the same way we certainly saw Lee Sedol was. Like, as I mentioned, Lee Sedol came in talking about how he was hoping it would be a clean sweep in his favor, and I loved watching these two characters over the course of this, both watching Demis slowly realize this is going better than I've ever realized, and watching Lee Sedol quickly realize this is going way worse than I ever thought this could go. And I thought it was particularly interesting with Lee Sedol in watching him grapple with that, and I really thought it was admirable beyond belief that he was able to mentally keep it together after such rough first three games to actually get a win off of AlphaGo in game 4, even if he found an area where it was slightly weaker than it would be in any other, and even if he did it by playing a move that it would never anticipate. I didn't know there was a 60-game winning streak online, but I was going to say I would be floored if he is not the only person who will ever get one game off of AlphaGo. I suspect it will be undefeated for the rest of its career.
And I don't know if Lee Sedol himself would get another game if they had a rematch. I think that may have been a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity right there. But it's interesting watching the documentary and seeing Demis on one side and his team, and then Lee Sedol on the other side. They come from very different cultures, but both of them are reserved. They're not like yelping and hollering whenever something happens. Even when AlphaGo wins this iconic, incredible victory, his reaction is so understated that it's comical. It's quintessentially British in a lot of ways. And then Lee Sedol on the other side, you can tell that he is a consummate professional. He doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve. He doesn't give anything away when he plays. But he is so overwhelmed by parts of this experience that he, as you see in the documentary, he feels the need to step outside and compose himself at various points during the match, which is not something that he does. That's not a usual part of his tournament procedure or anything, and that's normally because he's not facing an opponent that is anywhere close to on his level. And so this is a first time experience for him in so many different ways.
Right, and I mean I really do want to commend just like the mental resiliency. I can't imagine this number one player in the world who, after the first three games, like you said, the conclusion he has to have come to after these first three games is, oh my god, I know nothing about Go compared to what this computer knows. But he still shows up there for game 4 really playing to win and really wanting to give it his best despite having already lost the series. And I'm sure part of it was, I don't want to get shut out. Like, it would be great to get one win, but I really did appreciate, even as basically everything was not going his way, I think it is remarkable to see that just the resolve in Lee Sedol in staying focused and keeping his priority on winning and playing his best. I think that's why that is the exclusive domain of a world-class talented gamer, of being able to maintain that kind of disposition over the board in that kind of scenario. I can't even imagine a world-class computer, a world-class poker player, if they played against a computer that was just owning them constantly. I would guess most of them would tilt quit by the end of the third game, or drastically change their style or start calling bullshit or whatever. And to see Lee Sedol handle it so well, handle losing so well, and really still show up and play so well, I thought was one of my favorite parts of the entire movie.
As I was frantically writing the last parts of my thesis and scrambling to get that submitted, there were two simultaneous breakthroughs in poker AI happening in that week. And in both cases, the team behind the AI had it play against a team of top human pros, or top human pros, depending on your definition. It was interesting to see how at peace they were with their imminent defeat, as well as the fact that this was different from any other defeat they had suffered in the past. This isn't just a case of I played against someone and I didn't bring my best game on that given day, or I found someone who I think is a better player than me and I hope to learn from their example. This was a different type of event. This was a type of defeat that no player in poker had suffered before, and yet they were able to handle it with the same grace and equanimity as poker has taught them to handle so many defeats in the past. And I wonder if this is a common feature of people who are at the top of their fields in high pressure or high stakes situations like this, where you have to learn how to take losses and reflect on those and learn from those and not let that throw you off mentally and psychologically. And to be fair, there are still lots of well-known poker players who are well-known in part for their tilting off, for not handling losses well, and I'm sure that extends to other games as well. But I think this is a very useful characteristic to have if you want to be successful at anything, is knowing how to accept failure and knowing what to learn from it instead of just steering in your own misery, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I appreciated most about this movie, I've talked about just loving Lee Sedol's attitude in the face of defeat, but it really did seem like his major takeaway from the first three games was not to act defeated. It was, okay, this is not going my way. How can I learn from this and do better next time? And then he shows up to game four, having learned a bit and doing better this time. And I think that is a really important, just a lesson in life, not only in the game of Go, but just in general, of maintaining that focus and not letting the negative things get you down, I think is so crucial. And I love to see that come through here for Lee Sedol. All right. What more do you want to get to from this AlphaGo movie, Dom? We didn't talk about it in nearly the same detail that like we talked about King of Kong or I did with Johnny Fairplay, but there was so much more that was interesting that was just loosely related to this movie that I thought would be fun to get in there as well. But anything else from you, notes on the movie?
I was going to ask what you felt about the format of the movie overall, because in most documentaries like this, you have a hero and a villain, or you have a hero and an obstacle that they need to overcome. With AlphaGo, I don't think the movie took a clear stance on who we're meant to cheer for. So as humans, I guess we're naturally inclined to cheer for ourselves, but also you respect the amazing achievement that this would represent if AlphaGo was able to beat Lee Sedol, and also you grow to empathize to some extent with the team behind it. You see their efforts to get this in place, and you admire their professionalism. So in one sense, it's good because everyone in the movie comes off pretty well, as far as I can tell. But do you find that takes something away from the movie too? Because you know the stakes are high, but that's because of the magnitude of this scientific achievement that this would represent. It's not because you really want to see the protagonist overcome the odds and strike down the villain.
Oh, no, I see. I was very much into it, despite I did also know the way that the match ended up going. I didn't remember if Lee Sedol ended up getting a game off AlphaGo, but I did know he was going to get blown out over the course of the match. But I really did enjoy seeing, even knowing how the general trajectory of this was going to go, as I just talked about a bit. To me, what was so fascinating was everyone's state of mind as all of these changes in like who the favorite in the match was transpiring and how all of that was going. I loved seeing Fan Wei evolve from AlphaGo's first victim to member of the team and like one of the main narrators of how this actual match with Lee Sedol will end up going. He's there on the sidelines as one of the judges. I loved watching Lee Sedol as he evolved from world champion Michael Jordan of Go, who is confident he's going to potentially even clean sweep this pathetic computer that thinks it can hang with humans, and very quickly gets his comeuppance. And I loved watching the evolution of him kind of trying to overcome that. And then frankly, just watching all of the AlphaGo team, I guess this Deep Mind team, accomplish this mission that I think, to go back to a point we made earlier, seemed to be an endeavor that they embarked upon solely out of wanting to see if they could do it.
I'm curious if you, as someone who didn't know much about the subject coming in, if you felt you came away with any more knowledge, or you knew the wider context here, because it's almost like the documentary presented this singular moment and some of the steps leading up to it, but I don't know if it tried to place that in a larger context at all. So for a lot of documentaries like this, when you're introduced to the subject matter for the first time, you get this this clip or this montage of how this ties into things that we might be more familiar with, or you get this crash course in understanding the subject. And with this documentary, it's almost like they gave you enough credit that you wouldn't need that, but also if you did want that, they didn't offer that to you either. So I'm curious what your stance is on that.
I see what you're saying. To me, it was the larger story takeaway would be, this is a group of people who set out on a pretty improbable goal to try to get this computer to do something that no one thought could be done anytime soon, and to, at least as the movie presents it, think for itself. And this, again, we spent a lot of time talking about what that would actually mean, if a computer's even thinking, or what would qualify as intelligent if it was. But understanding that while it may not fit with your description or the artificial intelligence's, that community's general description of, okay, these guys just made a human robot or whatever. Like, I don't think they made like a Jetsons thing where we're going to be interacting with robots as if they're people anytime soon. But the movie seemed to me to be suggesting they wanted to take computer science to a totally new level. And over the course of this movie, they essentially did that. And that to me, I thought was really impressive. Even if it's not exactly true, that was my takeaway from the movie, is human kind is capable of getting beyond just the limits of the human brain.
Sure. So ultimately then, on a scale of 1 down to 10, Dan, what rating would you give AlphaGo?
I would say AlphaGo, Dom, you weren't here for the King of Kong podcast. Johnny Fairplay talked me into giving that a 10 in my very first podcast. AlphaGo is not, to me, on the same level as King of Kong, but I really did enjoy this documentary. There's a reason that we wanted to do this so soon into this series of podcasting about documentaries. I'm going to give AlphaGo a very solid 8 Don. How about you, Dom?
I would say 7 Dan or 7 Dom. That should be the scale instead, I think.
7
so.
Dom, like Dio, yeah. Like you.
I think for my own part, coming into it, knowing what to expect, or at least knowing some of the background, changed how I perceived it. So I think you and I were always going to see it a little bit differently, but definitely a solid watch. Would highly recommend it to anybody. And if somehow you have made it to this point in the podcast without having seen the documentary yet, give it a try. It's certainly worth your time.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Dom, for all of your insight today that I know a lot of people, certainly I, had absolutely no idea about so much of, and I really do think you added a lot to this whole movie.
I don't know how much I've advanced human understanding. I may have regressed it a little over the course of the past 2 hours, but I had a ton of fun doing this, and I'm very eager for feedback on this in particular. So if you have any thoughts on the format of this episode, or the content, or the way I presented it, then please get in touch and let us know, or if there's any other feedback too. So that's domandcolin@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter, as Colin said, @domhrv. You can find him, as I said, @ColinStone. And as always, thank you very much for listening.
Hopefully we can do another documentary very soon, or at least soon enough. I know we have a list growing of things that we'd like to, of documentaries we'd like to cover, so hopefully we can get to that. And I think that's going to do it. Thank you guys for anyone who made it this far. You are a true hero. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.